Hello and welcome to the EDH Retcast, where we're all about Commander, data, and dad jokes. I'm Joey Schultz and I'm joined by my fantastic co-hosts. Up first, he enters the battlefield with just like a whole bunch of stun counters on him. It's Matt Morgan.
So I recently made a new playlist for when I go out hiking. It's super good. I like it. It's got Eminem, the Cranberries, the theme song from Peanuts. I'm going to call it my trail mix.
Your trail mix. Matt, I hate to break it to you, but I knew that one already, and I think my dad jokes, my skills in the dad jokery are just like improving if I knew that one already.
No, you didn't know that one. You also probably didn't know that that mix also goes really well on your Hall and Oates meal, so...
Matt, you are cornier than Kansas in August, I swear.
Okay, hold up. I have to correct you.
Okay.
Kansas is full of wheat. Get it right. Oh. Nebraska and Iowa, there's nothing else but corn. I have to correct you. My identity as a resident of Kansas would not allow me to move on if I didn't step in there.
All right. Well, we know where your heart really is. When it comes to defending dad jokes versus the home state, we know where your heart lies now.
We do, yeah. Now move on to the person that's corn on the cob.
Okay. Up next, when he casts Talion Kindly Lord, which asks you to pick a number between 0 and 10, he's going to choose the number 10 every time just as a power move. It's Dana Roach.
Oh, well, by the time this show airs, we'll actually be in Las Vegas for the MagicCon, Sin City as it's called. Everyone knows that, but do you all know what Den City is?
Of course. Density is...
Mass divided by volume.
I see what you were going for now. Den City, Sin City.
A fraction of our listeners will actually probably get that joke. was that a mean thing to say?
I think you need to take your car and not go into the median with that joke.
Guys, of all of the openings we've ever had to our show, this one's probably the most average. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I would. I think
this is one of the most openings of all time.
You are correct. Of all the openings, this is one of them. All right. Let's actually try and like get back on some amount of rails. Dana, what is it that we're discussing in this episode this week?
We're doing a data check-in here for the first time since episode 244.
Yeah, been almost a year or so. We wanted to take a quick bird's eye view look at the format. There's one particular piece of news that I'm especially interested to get into. It is just kind of a health check, just like seeing where things are at, but there's some interesting information to get here that I'm excited to sink our teeth into. So we'll get into that in a quick moment because we got some shout outs to do first.
First, I'd like to thank Chase, also known as Mana Curves, for helping editing the show. You can find them online at Mana Curves.
And if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by liking and subscribing on YouTube. You can subscribe in your local podcast app, or you can go to patreon.com/EDHRecCast, where we have patron tiers of all sorts of levels. Whether you want to join the Discord community that we have, you want to see all the episodes a day early, there's all that and more over at patreon.com/EDHRecCast, including the coveted weekly patron shout-out. So this week, we are going to give a super special shout-out to Xavier Gualtney. That's just a mouthful of a name, but Xavier, there's no puns, just Gualtney. There's a lot going on there.
No puns. Are you sure, Matt? Because I think that's a Gualt neat last name.
I mean, maybe he's related to Gualt Disney.
Oh, man.
Famous animator, Mickey Mouse. Xavier, either way, thank you for the support. We definitely appreciate it.
Very, very much. Thank you ever so, Xavier. All right, well, guys, we're going to get into our topic here now, doing a quick data check-in, just observing a couple of interesting numbers and especially interesting trends over the Commander format. Notice any differences that have happened over the past couple of years. So we'll be measuring a couple of things like, what's the color balances look like? Like, which are the most popular colors? How many legends on average appear in the 99s? What are mana curves looking like these days? But real quick, I think we've got to start off with just a really huge figure here. Dana, I'll throw this one to you. How much is going on in the EDH Rec database? Because it looks like a real big number to me, and I don't want to read it out loud because that's a lot of numbers.
So the last time we checked in, there was about 1.86 million decks in the database. And that was a year-ish ago. There's over 3 million right now. And bear in mind, astronomical as that number is, it's decks have fallen off. Like, we don't just continuously add to that number. That means that in addition to having, you know, 1.2 million more than we had when we did this last, decks have fallen off. So, like, that number is actually even larger than it kind of looks if you really think about it.
Yeah. And so what Dana means is the decks in the database, that 3 million decks number, that's just decks that have been updated in the past 2 years. For those of you who don't know, EDH Rec, if a deck hasn't been updated in over 2 years, we drop it out of our results just to make sure that all the information is current, all the information is relevant that you're going to be seeing. That way you're not seeing how decks were built, you know, 3-4 years ago, because that's not really helpful in today's format. And so 3 million decks in the past 2 years.
Yeah.
If we were looking at all-time numbers, I'm sure that would be quite a bit higher, obviously, but also maybe the information you get out of that wouldn't be near as helpful. So 3 million helpful decks is a massive number.
Yeah, yeah, very much. Especially the decks of yore, the decks of like 7-8 years ago, where Return to Dust was a lot more of a thing, for example. That might not be the kind of thing that we're playing as much these days. And so it's nice to keep up with those trends. And 3 million is so much. 3,016,907 to be exact. And I said I didn't want to say numbers, but there I go. Yeah, that's wild. I think it's safe to say that Commander has never been more popular. We already know it's the most popular way to play Magic, especially multiplayer Magic, but like, wow, what a striking resonant thing that is. And that's just a big figure that I'm just like, yo, congrats, we passed 3 million.
Like, if you break it down, 3 million decks is like basically on average one deck for every new Commander that was released in 2023.
That's not far off. And I'm sure we're going to have a few tidbits of data to back that up.
I mean, I did some rounding, but like, it's close.
Some rounding. Yeah, I think since the last time that we did this episode, we have actually gotten 265 new legends added to the format, actually, which is just like, yeah, it's a lot. But we've got other, yeah, we'll get to that in a bit. There's actually one figure that I think would be most interesting for us to start with, because it was a takeaway that we really lingered on back when we did this on episode 244. We were doing a data check-in. Specifically, we were talking about mana curves, because there was a lot of interesting information that happened back then. Matt, do you want to catch us up about what was happening when we last looked at mana curves?
Yeah, so we checked in, and we'd like to do this every couple years. So in the first few years of us doing the podcast, we were really digging into the past 2 years, mana curves were, they were averaging about 3.51 was the average mana value in a given deck. Well, over the next couple years, kind of the 2020-2022 timeframe, it got down to 3.08 for the average mana value, which is significantly lower when you think about all the things that have to be going on for it to dip that low. But the average mana curve for the past year or so has actually gone up in decks. So the average mana value in any given deck now is 3.19, which is super, super surprising to say, because last time we did this episode, we were predicting them to get even leaner. So to see them go up is quite a surprise.
Yeah, last time we did this, we had a little bit of a debate about, like, would it keep going down? At what pace would it keep going down? I went back and listened to it a bit, and I think it wasn't like we were like, oh, alarmist, sky is falling. It certainly wasn't that, but Dana, I do remember you really anticipating that the optimization would cause things to go down possibly even faster, and it looks like that isn't true, which I think we're all just kind of happy to see. Like, it's nice to see, oh, it seems like maybe the mana curves have kind of stabilized a little bit, going back up from 3.08 up to 3.19. It's not the most enormous change in the world, but it's nice to see that it's not continuing inevitably in a downward trend, for instance.
Yeah, and there could be a lot of reasons for that. I mean, if there's a bunch of new players that have came into the game that tend to be playing less optimized decks, that could be skewing in that direction as well. I mean,
sure.
But, like, Joey, you did an episode of your kind of standalone YouTube video series you did talking about the evolution of a Commander player just like a week or two ago, and talked about some of the changes that you made. Kind of, it's not really a bell curve, but like, you do that thing where you come into the game, you get more optimized, and then sometimes people like turn the other direction with that. You mentioned how you have done that. I think we've all done an element, a degree of that. And I do wonder if the player base is not doing the same thing a little bit. People have been playing a little bit. Now they're a little more entrenched. They've taken that journey where they're like, you know, maybe I don't need Vamp Tutor in every deck. Maybe I don't need Mana Crypt in every deck. So I think we perhaps some of this is that swing.
See, there's so many factors that are going to play into this. It's really hard to tell and say like, oh, this is what's doing it. Mm-hmm. I think actually one of the big factors, at least in my own experience on why my mana value, the average mana value, I should say, of my decks is going up, is just because they're printing so many specific support cards that we keep praising all the time that eventually those are going to start working into every deck. I'm taking out maybe a 3-mana kill spell for a 4-mana because it has a little bit more upside for the specific deck I'm playing, for example. That's something that I do all the time. I mean, I've talked about Astarion's Thirst and how it's so versatile in +1/+1 counter decks, commander-specific decks. And so that's one that I've taken out and maybe dropped a couple other popular removal spells because I have situational spells. Maybe they're 1 or 2 mana more, but they're so much more flexible and there's just upside to them. That's one thing that's influenced me. And so maybe that's more widespread in the general player base too.
Interesting. I don't think that is my experience.
Sure.
I would say that actually like my removal spells, particularly my pinpoint removal spells, still tend to be one of those places where I find myself erring towards optimized stuff, especially when we've gotten all these things that just randomly have like Ward 2 printed on them. It's nice to not have to turn a generous gift into a 5-mana spell, for instance. So for my pinpoint removal, my targeted removal, I tend to still stay optimized on that. I do like finding those fun situational support cards like you mentioned. And like those, especially if they are situational, but they can cause a huge blowout. Like some of those types of spells are especially fun. Like I always look at Crafty Cut Purse and I'm just like, can I justify playing you, for example? Like those are really fun. The thing that I think would kind of lead me, if I were to just look at my own decks and if I observe this type of trend, I would say it's possibly not in the removal spells, but actually maybe more weighted towards like the big stuff when like the big rewards, like a Breach the Multiverse, for example. I think possibly it's the case that there have been more compelling new really big payoffs that you're excited to get to in the late game that are just slightly pulling the numbers up a tad bit. I think that a lot of the stuff that is down in the optimized world is still like relatively optimized, cheap removal spells, that kind of deal. But like the really big, exciting, splashy stuff, those ones might be the ones tugging at the numbers, at least based off of me thinking of like the exciting cards that I've been putting into my decks recently. That's where my mind goes. But again, as you said, there are so many variables, it's hard to know precisely what it could be. So who knows?
Yeah, like to look at my decks, for example, you know, we've talked plenty about 3-mana mana rocks that they've been printing the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. I guarantee that's swung a lot of my decks a couple points in various directions, because when that, you know, the Throne of Eldraine comes out, or, you know, a Midnight Clock, or whatever card it winds up being, whatever 3-mana rock, Crowded Crypt, that kind of thing, I'm pulling a 2-mana rock. Like that's where I'm like, well, I don't have a lot of room in this deck. I guess Felwar Stone's coming out or something. So like if you do that a couple times and I wind up cycling, you know, 2 3-mana rocks into my decks, it's usually at the cost of a couple of 2-mana rocks. So all of these things incrementally probably add up here or there to just kind of swing these curves just a little bit.
And they really have been printing a lot of amazing 3-mana rocks. I mean, we've been banging that drum for a while, but like Wand of the World Soul that gives your stuff Convoke, for instance, Glistening Sphere to proliferate, Gatewatch Beacon to help out your Planeswalkers, Relic of Legends, Matt, I know that's one that you really, really love because it's not just capable of giving you only 1 mana. Mm-hmm. Like in the past year, we got some really spicy ones. So like, I hope that those are having a good influence.
Yeah, just anything that just, it's those small incremental upgrades, whereas before we used to see those small incremental optimization moves where it's remove a mana here and there. Now it's more, okay, well, I'm going to get a little bit more upside if I do this. I'm going to get a little more upside if I do that. Mm. And over the course of time, it's just adding a little bit more mana back into the average deck.
And by the way, as a quick point of clarification on this, when we're looking at the average mana curve being 3.19, that doesn't include lands. If we were to include lands, it would drop to like 2.08, I think was the number when we were calculating it. So this doesn't include lands. Our calculation on that front has never included the lands. And if people are wondering, like, is 3.19 high? Is that low? Is that big or whatever? For a quick context, it's impossible for us to measure all of the CEDH decks because that's not how data is aggregated, is like being specifically labeled that way. But when looking at a lot of the most popular CEDH decks that are out there, pretty commonly the mana curve that we encountered out there was like 2.1, or if you removed all the lands, the average mana curve was 1.5. So to let you know, like, based off of that, that's like a full point off, which is actually pretty darn big, especially since it took 4 years for things to go down from 3.5 to 3.08. So just quick numbers out there, quick clarifications, just felt like that would be prudent for us to make sure we mention.
Well, I talked about how we had 3 million legends printed in the last year or so, and I guess that's not strictly true, even if you take into account the amount of rounding I did. but we definitely did see a kind of a change there, too, in how many legends are in the 99. And not just legendary creatures, just legends in general. From 2018 to 2020, we were averaging just under 6 legends per deck, so 5.9. That next window, 2020 to 2022, 8.9. So that's a pretty big jump. But that's actually kept, this one has kept trending upwards. We're 2021 to 2023, just under 10, 9.6 legendary cards. 10% of your deck, basically, are legendary cards.
Well, and when you look at a previous episode that we did a couple weeks ago about the eras of Commander design, that 2020 to 2022 timeframe lines up with that just massive explosion of everything suddenly is legendary. And now we're actually seeing it in the data. Like, not just every card is legendary, but now every card in decks is now becoming legendary too.
Oh, yeah. And those numbers you mentioned there, that's for legendary cards, not specifically for legendary creatures. Mm-hmm. And if folks are curious how the trends have been for creatures, looking just at the average number of legendary creatures in the 99 of decks, from the 2018 to 2020 window, there were an average of 2. From the 2020 to 2022 window, it jumped up to 4.8. And now here, when we're looking at the past 2 years here in 2023, it's an average of 5.9. And so that's the number of average legendary creatures in the deck versus just, you know, random cards that happen to be legendary, like Planeswalkers or Sword of the Animist, stuff like that. Now there are sometimes up to like between 5 and 6 legends in the typical EDH deck, like legendary creatures in typical EDH deck. And that's a big change from where we were a couple of years ago. So this number does seem to not be stabilizing necessarily, which I guess is hardly surprising when, Dana, as you said, we're getting millions of legends all the time.
Well, and it's not just that it went up from 2 to 6, it tripled. I think that's a better way to put it for some people to think like me. It's not just, oh, it went up by 4. It tripled in how many times you're putting a legendary creature in the 99 of a deck. And that's significant because most of the time it used to be legendary creatures were designed to be at the helm of a deck. Well, now they're just designed to be in decks. And it's significant to see those numbers jumping up as much as they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we also got a couple cycles in the last couple of years of really, really good legendary lands that show up in a ton of decks as well. So like that's a thing that's also probably ratcheting those numbers upwards. But the other thing that's worth talking about, because we've made this comment before, as WotC has designed more legendary creatures and they've shown up in decks, we've seen them look for ways to work around the downside of that by printing things that make copies of cards that ignore the legendary rule. And we've kind of not necessarily loved that design. It's like they maybe dipped their toes into that water a little bit too often. But like that's kind of how the stuff works. They print more legends, so then they have to find ways to compensate for that legendary rule and how you can't copy that stuff. And so they print clone effects that work around that. And like, are we going to get some response to that down the road? Maybe we'll see. It's interesting to see the push and pull of these things and how they affect how design affects future design, that kind of stuff.
It is, yeah. Just lingering on that, and like, I'm really sad that Irenicus's Vile Duplication is a really good card. Like, Helm of the Host types of effects, those are really, really cool. But I don't like taking away the thing that legendary is supposed to mean. It's just a personal thing. Maybe this is me becoming a boomer. If so, I am sorry. But I get that it's a feel bad for a new player to not fully understand. It's just like, oh, I can't have 2 copies of this. But there are so many of them running around as they print more and more of them. So I get why design would make this choice to make it easier to get into this. And you can still do fun things like making copies, even when there are so many. But like, that's what legend is supposed to mean, is that there can be only one, right? So I'm like, aw. And yet I'm still playing Irenicus's Vile Duplication as much as I can because it's a dang good card. But like, I'm just like, anyway, just it was a tidbit.
Well, I mean, like, if you want to talk about like how many copies of a thing that are in a deck, there's a whole segment we do here where we can break down whether or not they're running too many copies of a card like Irenicus's Vile Duplication.
Dana, You didn't officially segue into challenge the stats, so I'm going to say that I'll take that from you because you didn't actually say the words. So is that mine?
You're right, Joey. We can share that one. Teamwork makes a dream work.
I would count that as a dub for me, I think.
I don't know.
Survey says, ding.
We know the segue was started in spirit by Dana.
I think he just set me up for it, and he lobbed and I spiked the ball down.
Well, I mean, still, Steve Nash wouldn't have been great without all those people to throw it to. And that's a sports reference, Joey, that I know you're not going to get. Kind of like the segue that you're also not going to get.
Goodness gracious. All right, yeah. We will take a quick break because there's a whole lot of other data to look at on EDH Rec that we might have a little bit of disagreement with. So we will pause and come back with Challenge the Stats. All right, I've got a funky underplayed card here that I want to say we probably challenged way back on like episode 6 or something like that, but the numbers on it have certainly not changed, and it's a very interesting card. Grim Feast is a weird little Golgari enchantment that if you like death and you like life gain, it's probably up your alley. It is a 3-mana Golgari enchantment. At the beginning of your upkeep, it deals 1 damage to you, but whenever an opponent's creature goes from play to their graveyard, you gain life equal to its toughness. There's so much death that happens in the format. I have seen this thing in play, and it looked like, it doesn't seem like it's going to do a whole lot. And then a couple of creatures died in combat, and then a board wipe happened, and then suddenly, oh no, you've gained actually like 30 life or something. Like, if you're playing a Willow Dusk deck or a Dina Soulsteeper deck and you care very directly about life gain, this thing lines up really, really perfect for you. It's just a very unknown card, only in about 1,300 decks right now. But if you really want to stabilize your life total, the amount of life that you will gain off of this card is so astronomically higher than the amount of damage that it could possibly do to you on your upkeep. Really give this one a look. I promise it gives you a stinking stupid amount of life. Grim Feast, check it out.
Well, let me go next, Joey. So I've got our listener submitted challenge this week. So Drunk Wookie in our Discord, that sounds violent, but had a very good challenge, actually. So good on you, Drunk Wookie. They said, my challenge is for any Orzhov roll card in Ariat of the Charmed Apple decks. This is kind of a non-bow people might not be noticing yet since it's in the early days of the deck. Among the 15 Orzhov roll cards, as in cards that have the roll ability to give them to creatures, every single one of them targets only creatures you control, where Ariat wants you to enchant enemy creatures for protection. The overplayed cards that they're challenging is cards like Lord Skitter's Blessing, Spellbook Vendor, and Conceited Witch, which those are all showing up in a decent amount of the Ariat deck. So this is a really good catch when you want to consider, are you putting things on creatures that you control, that opponents control, anything like that? This is a very, very good specific catch that I think a lot of players, like you pointed out, Drunk Wookie, may not be realizing yet, just since it is so early in the deck. So this is a really good catch. I like this idea. And so make sure you're taking a critical look at any roll cards that you are putting into the decks.
That's a very good shout, because Ariat prevents stuff that you've enchanted that your opponents control from being able to attack you. So why enchant your own stuff? Yeah, that's a great challenge.
So I've been working on a Dimir Voltron deck off and on for years, and in the newest iteration here I've been playtesting lately, Howl from Beyond is a card I've always liked. It's an instant speed X spell, and basically you can pump a creature up for the mana you pump into it. Being instant speed, it's a very nice combat trick as well. As I've been playtesting this deck, though, like, I felt like I wanted one or two more of those effects. And the closest thing to an amount of black is a sorcery speed version of it called Blood Curdling Scream. But the fact that it's sorcery speed feels kind of bad for a one-off effect. It's worth pumping a bunch of mana into Howl from Beyond because you can kind of do it as a surprise. When you're telegraphing it, pumping a bunch of mana into the spell for one turn doesn't feel nearly as effective. However, what I wound up stumbling across was a card that's only in about 900 decks currently from Tempest called Endless Scream. I missed Endless Scream the first half dozen times I was looking for because it's an enchantment. And it just reads, enchanted creature gets +X/+0, and it costs X and a black to cast. But how it's been eroded is it says it enters the battlefield with X scream counters on it, and enchanted creature gets +1/+0 for each scream counter on Endless Scream. So while it's still sorcery speed, although it's an enchantment, it's slow, it's not a surprise. it stays buffed up. So when you put 6 mana or 8 mana into that creature, it's going to be equally large next turn. It's a Howl from Beyond that's slow, it's easier to respond to, but that mana sticks around. And for me, that's been a huge difference. Bloodcurling Scream didn't do what I wanted it to do. Endless Scream has been very good in the testing of that deck. So if you are playing some kind of a deck that's looking for a pump effect, Endless Scream is really quite good, and it's really easy to miss because of the way it's worded as an enchantment. It keeps the creature buff for multiple turns, and I think it should be in more than just 900 decks. That's an effect you want. It's very, very good.
You can proliferate the Scream counters. Are you kidding? Especially because the effects, the decks that are going to want that type of effect the most, like, let's be honest, it's going to be like Skitherix decks, especially, or the types of decks that are playing this most often. So, like, a Skitherix deck is already going to be playing a whole bunch of proliferate because you want to infect people to bits. So, like, wow, what a 1-2 punch, Dana. This is, like, one of those cards that I saw when I first started playing the game that I put out of my mind, and now I'm having, like, a full-on nostalgia attack from you challenging this.
Way back in Tempest, and it's a whole 22 cents, so easy to pick up and try for your deck as well. I would give it a go.
Well, sweet deal, fellas. I think we're going to get back into our main topic here now. And the next thing to get into, it's a funny little number that we were able to look at last year when we did this type of data check in episode, and it has to do with the like total number of eligible commanders and how they're balanced out in terms of like deck population out there. And I think that this is also pretty fascinating, especially to see whether and how it's changed. So last year when we looked, there were about 1,604 eligible possible commander cards out there. Obviously with things like partners, that's like, it gets very, very complicated to get an exact calculation, but there were roughly 1,604 things that could be in your command zone. And of those, the top 179 of those legends had the same number of decks as the other 1,425. So about 11% of the top commanders had the same number of decks as the other 89%. That's what it was looking like last year. But guys, what is it looking like this year?
Well, this year, I mean, so we got 265 new possible options to put in the command zone for a grand total of 1,869 options. So of those, the top 212 legends have the same number of decks as the rest of the other 1,657. So it's so top heavy. You know, when you think about, oh, there's the 80-20 rule that you have for different things in life. This applies only in even more extreme, because this is top 10%-ish that all of the decks are being concentrated into.
It's the same figure. It's also 11%. Although, Matt, you just mentioned the 80-20 rule, and not everyone may be familiar with that, so it might be good for us to clarify real quick.
So the 80-20 rule is basically that 80% of your results or anything like that is going to come from 20% of the field, or 80% of the workload is going to get done by the top 20% of your performers at work and business. So it's just kind of a different kind of business rule that a lot of people will incorporate into life. You should focus 80% of your attention to the top 20% most productive things, whatever it is. So it's just a general rule saying, whatever you want to say, but it's even more pronounced by, you know, we're seeing a 90-10 split in the division as far as allocation of how many commanders are getting all the decks.
So guys, what do we think? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing with this split?
I mean, I don't think it's a bad thing necessarily, particularly given the amount of commanders that they're printing. I would wager a similar thing, you know, was happening 10 years ago too, when we would only get 5 commanders with a set. We've talked about how in the past, when we would get these small amounts, you know, 3 of them would be pretty terrible anyway. Like, people tended to focus their attention on those ones that were really good. The same thing's kind of happening today. It's just kind of a larger scale. You know, they print 5 and like 1 would be decent. We'll say they print 50 and 10 are decent. You know, you're seeing kind of a similar thing, I think. And decent, I don't mean decent. I just mean like really with a really good build path that's going to allow you to build a very powerful commander with a very powerful deck plan. Like that's kind of something, whether it was Krenko Mob Boss 10 years ago that we would get, or is Miriam Sentinel Worm today. Like it's telling you what you want to do, and it's very strong. And I think roughly that's always going to happen, and people are always going to be attracted to those decks. And I don't think it's necessarily bad or good. It just is how these things tend to work out.
Yeah, Dana, I think that's really well observed. A lot of these things, like we see these big numbers, like it doesn't have to be a good thing or a bad thing. Sometimes it's just a thing and we can just see how it all plays out from there. We saw that that's a figure, the 11%, the 90-10-ish sort of split, kind of hasn't changed a whole lot. Another thing that also hasn't changed from last year was also basically the color breakdown in terms of how many decks out there are monocolor, how many decks are two-color, three-color, four-color, five-color, how many are colorless, things like that. It is exactly the same figures as last year. 17% of the decks out there in the world are monocolor. 40% of the decks out there are two-color. We've got like 31 being three colors. We've got almost nothing being colorless. 7% on the five colors. Like, yeah, it's a whole lot of stuff hasn't changed. And I guess that's also nice to see, question mark.
The variance being less than 0.5% away from what it was the last time we looked at these, it like the fact that this among all things is so steady, it's kind of surprising that there isn't any change actually, because you'd think that with how Wizards of the Coast is experimenting with so many different things, surely some sway would go around, but no, it's steady as it goes. And that's, again, everything else is changing about this format. I figured this would have as well, but that the surprise that didn't change.
Yeah, so this feels to me like something that's indicative of a lack of a thing. So like, scientists can detect black holes by looking for a lack of light in space. The lack of change here seems to indicate lack of a problem, kind of. Like I feel like, sure, myself personally, once upon a time, there were probably colors, particularly red and white, that I tended to avoid a little bit in Commander decks because they were lacking tools that I felt I needed to have to play the game. And I personally don't feel like I dodge those colors anymore necessarily. And I wonder how much of this stabilization is because they've just kind of patched over a lot of the issues that some of these colors and color pairs once had. So people are just playing what they want to play, and we're not seeing big swings and changes anymore because people aren't dodging white and red like they maybe once did. They're just building the deck they want to build, and so we're not seeing those changes. It's indicating a lack of a problem, perhaps.
Interesting. See, the takeaway for me is it's noteworthy to me that there hasn't been any change, especially given the certain types of precons or areas of design focus that have happened over the past year or so. For example, to see that the colorless decks are still basically less than 1%, to see that hasn't changed despite they just made a new colorless precon, for instance. I mean, that did not shift any needles. To see that it's still basically the same even after we had a devoted three-color set like New Capenna didn't really budge the needle a whole lot. We've gotten multiple five-color pre-constructed decks. Again, it's still 6.9%. Basically 7% of the field out there is five-color. And it's interesting to note that those things have remained the same. And to me, this kind of reads as a small note that like the effect that a single pre-constructed deck release can have on the format is not as pronounced as once it used to be. Because I think we did used to see bigger swings when like, oh, here is a full design focus that's coming out. These things are going to swell the numbers for two-color decks. These things are going to swell the numbers for three-color decks. That is no longer present because there's just so much going on right now that these are kind of nary a drop in the bucket, as it were. And I think that's notable. That doesn't make me feel like the precons are any less valuable, and I think the designs in them are still very interesting, but it is just noteworthy, like, oh yeah, we got a whole on a big bunch of stuff and a lot of these different interesting color combinations, and that hasn't changed the status quo of the things that people most are interested in building, and that's just kind of interesting to see.
Yeah, I think it's very, very important to point out that just because the pre-constructed decks don't cause these massive ripple effects doesn't mean they're not impactful.
Yeah.
I still think they're an incredibly valuable tool to getting players into the game, getting them in a controlled, okay, here's a deck that you don't have to worry about, you know, piecing together, because that's quite a daunting task when you're first getting into the game. I totally get that. Pre-constructed decks definitely have a place, but are they shifting, making these huge, huge waves? Definitely not. And I think that's just a testament to the plethora of options that we have these days.
Yeah. And you know what? It's nice to see that even though we've gotten nearly no new four-color designs, it's still at 3.5-ish% of the format breakup. Good for it. I'm glad that it hasn't like fallen off a cliff or anything like that. That's nice. We also have some specific popular colors. Guys, what do you think? Should we start with three-color, monocolor, two-color, the most popular color combinations? Where do you want to go?
Well, one is the loneliest number, so let's start there. And that has no no practical reason for us to do it other than it's top of our list on our notes, and let's just do that.
All right, if you insist. Honestly, not a whole lot has changed here either. We saw previous years that mono black was in the lead. Yep, it still is. If anything, it's gotten up a little bit more popular than it used to be by like 2%. Red is the second most popular mono color, and white, tragically, is still the least popular. Green is taken up the middle. Good for it. Blue has kind of, you know, fallen down a little bit, actually, which I'm really surprised to see. But yeah, black is the best mono color, and I think that we can all just rest assured that that's the best, and I am not biased here by being a necromancy kind of guy. So yeah, this is just
being cool. A necromancy. that's a sentence you said.
I said a necromancy kind of guy.
But white being just a couple percentage points behind green, green that feels like it has all the answers to all the things, and white for a long time felt like it didn't. Only 3 points difference between those two colors. That feels pretty good. I think that indicates things are relatively stable, and they've addressed some of the issues perhaps.
Yeah, I think when we talked about this last, you mentioned, Dana, that one of the reasons that green might not be like number one in the way that I think a lot of people probably were expecting it to be is that a lot of its win conditions tend to feel like a lot of its other win conditions.
Yeah.
Whereas with some of the other colors like black or with red, you do get a little bit more exciting and varied stuff in the win conditions, I think if I'm remembering your take on that one, which is also probably one of the reasons that white has yet to capture us quite as much, because a lot of white's win conditions also tend to look a lot like a lot of other white's other win conditions of like, hey, do you have an army? Go smash.
So. And green's win conditions, to be frank. Roll that Moonshaker cavalry on screen.
Oh, definitely. Well, those are just the mono colors, but I mean, one might have been the loneliest number. Matt, what about the two color combinations? What's going on with them? What's the most popular two color combo?
Well, so we're just going to go top to bottom because there's a lot of data to get into. So I'm just going to run through it real quick. The most popular still going to be the Dimir Guild. So blue, black right there. Coming up second, Golgari, followed by Simic, so a lot of black, a lot of green, a lot of blue. Followed up in fourth place, the Izzet, then Rakdos, so blue-red, and then red-black accordingly. Followed up by Gruul, so the red-green, and then in seventh place, Orzhov, and eighth, the Azorius, so you have blue-white. Ninth in Boros, and then tenth, man, I don't know what everybody out there in listener land is doing, but Selesnya is in last place, and that is egregious. So I need everybody to go up and just build some Selesnya decks. Build green white. It's the best color combination. I don't know what everybody else is doing wrong.
I'm sorry, Matt. I mean, I do kind of understand, though. Like, when you look at the Selesnya commanders out there, there's only one of them that has over 10,000 decks, and that's Sithis Harvest Sand. And you know what? Good for Sithis. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. But the next commander in the Selesnya line has only half that amount, and that's Kyler, which I know you love your Kyler. I know you love Kyler.
I do love Kyler.
But that's a drop-off of, like, it's 50% as popular as Sithis. And so, like, there's a lot of interest in one specific area, but not in the broad areas, I guess. And that's just, I understand it's unfortunate to see. But Golgari's near the top, and that's really what we need to talk about these days, because the necromancy, my guy.
Yeah, I mean, if you asked me to pick what color pairs tend to have the most interesting commanders, it would be Dimir and Golgari. That said, Simic wouldn't probably crack my, you know, top eight. But I definitely feel like, at least in terms of, like, when I look at the commanders that are available in those two color pairs, particularly one at number one and number two, I'm like, yeah, I get why folks tend to build those commanders. I do feel like there's a lot of diversity and interesting stuff, which is not the case with Selesnya, where I do think it suffers from having many interesting options to build with there.
Interesting, yeah. I find it interesting that Rakdos has actually budged down a little bit. I think that Prosper Tomebound did a whole lot to really, like, introduce Rakdos to a new way of being for a while, but as we've all gotten to know it a little bit better, the novelty has sort of subdued a bit, and now there's more of a regularity to it, so we're looking for new things in all these color combinations for sure. I remember speculating when we looked at these types of figures the other year that I was, like, hoping that some of these colors would be, like, due for a renaissance of, like, a reinvention, because some of these colors are getting new ways of interpreting them. Like, for a long time, for example, Rakdos was just kind of the color of the chaos and the demons. And then we got like, oh, it's doing Play Out of Exile stuff. And that was an exciting new thing to get into. And that really helped to bump up the different things that you could do in all of the Rakdos decks out there. It just seems like Selesnya needs to find its thing. Boros and Orzhov and Azorius have also kind of always populated the bottom four there. And I would really love for them to break into one of the top spots one of these days. But But I think in general, their play patterns are still relatively known to us. And so that novelty hasn't gotten them to breach into the top four, for example.
Yeah, I mentioned how I felt like WotC has solved a lot of the problems that scared people away maybe from colors and color pairs, but they haven't necessarily solved the problems that make you want to play those color pairs. Like they made me not want to dodge Boros, but they haven't done much to make me want to play Boros.
I mean, that's still a project that they're working on. But, I mean, they have definitely made strides. I think that's one thing that we do want to make sure. Especially in the past year, strides have definitely been made.
Well, and so that takes us through our monocolor and our two-color options. But let's round it out here with the most popular three-color combinations out there. In first place, good for it, is Esper. The white, the blue, the black. Good for it, leading the pack. Followed very closely by Grixis. And then Mardu, which has always been a big, big favorite for many, many years. Naya in fourth place. Sultai in fifth place, which is interesting to me. Jund down in sixth. Teemer, then Bant, Jeskai, and rounding it out in last place is still Abzan. I'm very sorry, Jeskai and Abzan. Y'all are still at the bottom of the pack. But yeah, kind of an interesting little thing to see there that Esper's up at the top. I know that we've all I think there's a big thing in the community thinking that Sultai has got to be number one. I think a lot of people will think that Simic must have been number one, but actually not necessarily so. It's interesting to see where those color combinations actually wind up.
Yeah, again, I this is a situation where I feel like Esper and Grixis tend to have the most identity. Like, I very much know what I'm looking at when someone says it's an Esper deck or a Grixis deck. There's there's an intangible feel to them that feels very identifiable to me in a way that the other eight triple color combinations don't necessarily have. So again, I'm not terribly surprised to see those two there. They just have some vibe, some feeling, some sense of identity that I think probably makes them a little more attractive than the rest.
Well, and I think it's a battle of shards versus wedges, too, because if you look at three of the bottom four, they're wedges. You got the Teemer, the Jeskai, and the Abzan, whereas when you look at the top ones, it's the opposite. So three of the top four are going to be the wedges, so you have the Esper, Grixis, and Naya. So it is kind of interesting that they're placed so starkly against each other. Maybe it's because I'm kind of defeating my own argument, because last time we were in Ikoria, we had a major three color focus, and you would have thought that would have kind of helped propel some of those bottom ones there. We just got an Abzan colored Enchantress deck, and that hasn't really budged the numbers either. So
yeah,
it's interesting to me to see that shards versus wedges, where wedges are definitely winning that battle.
I mean, yeah, I was going to mention that too about the Abzan precons that we've gotten, because we didn't just get the Anixia deck. We also got the Sam and Frodo, the Food and Fellowship deck. We also got the Ixhel, the Infect deck. Not only that, but we also got a very popular commander, Thalia and the Gitrog Monster, came out around the March of the Machine time. We've actually gotten a lot of attention recently for the Abzan color combination, but they just haven't really caught the interest in the way that other stuff has. And that is fascinating. I wonder if it's maybe a little bit of the new Capenna effect is still directing a lot of attention more towards the Grixis and the Nayas and the Espers. And maybe we'll see that fall off in time. But I am personally just astonished that Abzan, with all of that extra attention and, let's be honest, invention, the new ways of taking Infect, new ways of taking food tokens and putting those on the map. We did get novelty in that color combination and it's still not budging. And I'm just I believe in you though, buddy.
Yeah, it's cute. It's, it's interesting to try to, we can guess at this, but what actually makes something resonate with players is very much a mystery in a lot of ways. And yeah, I agree. There's I feel like there's been attempts to address that. There should have budged those numbers, but they just haven't.
Well, guys, we chewed through a whole lot of data here. I am really interested to see what the listeners think about this stuff. And the mana curves thing still stands out to me as one of the most notable things for us to take away here. That certain things are stabilizing. There's a lot of non-movement that's going on that is also just as interesting as the movement that we do see. I don't know. Do we have any final thoughts or maybe predictions about where things might be going from here?
I mean, you used the word stabilization. I think that's what we're looking at. I think we are just, we've seen the stabilization of the format. They're not stopping printing a crazy amount of cards for us to play in this format. There's, you know, going to be just as many releases in 2024 as there were in 2023. That's not going to change. But I do think a lot of these numbers have evened out because they've just fixed a lot of the problems for the most part. And the format's also gotten so big that like one really good commander isn't, a really popular commander isn't going to swing things maybe the way it once did as well. So everything's just stabilized, both in terms of design, in terms of the stats, in terms of the player base. I think we're going to continue to see a lot of this stuff really level out.
Gotcha. There is one that I think will continue to inflate, and that's going to be the number of legends within the 99.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Just sort of inevitably, I think that that's still a balloon that we could see burst in some ways, but I don't know how. So like, I think that that number will still go up, but I do think that in a lot of the other cases, it's nice to see like, all right, there's a nice cozy kind of lean back. All right, this seems to be the state of things. And as the state of things go, all right, I'm into it. So yeah, Matt, same feelings, or do you want a whole lot of change?
I would have to say if there is a big change that I want to see, I hope the mana curve continues to go up, actually. I want to see mana values get in there. I want to see people casting these big, splashy, expensive things. So hopefully that trend continues to evolve and go back up. It's funny how we talked about it last year when we were going to get to diminishing returns when it comes to optimization at some point. Maybe we've hit that. I don't know. Hopefully we have, because I would like to see people kind of get back to the origins of the format when it comes to casting these big impressive things and kind of exploring the identity of the deck rather than the urge to optimize to the maximum level.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good lesson. Although it's very possible that the situation we'll actually run into is when we check in again next year, it's dropped down to like 2.6 or whatever, and this is just a blip.
Right, yeah.
Like that could watch that happen to us. Honestly, I'm calling it now. Next year when we check in for this, that'd be very, very funny if we end up getting completely blindsided.
Right, but, just blown out, yep.
Yeah, that'll be a fun day. Fingers crossed it doesn't actually happen. But listeners, we also want to hear from you what you think about all of these different numbers. Are things in different places than you thought they would be? Let us know. But for now, we're going to call this episode to a close. Fellas, if our listeners would like to get in touch with you, where is it that they can find you on the onlines? Matt?
So you can find me on pretty much any social media platform at MathMiss55. The handle is always going to be the same. You can also find us Wednesday evenings. We're streaming over at twitch.tv/EDHRetcast with a guest on every single week. So make sure you tune in for that too.
And Dana?
You can find me online at Dana Roach. I'm writing articles for EDH Rec and Commander's Herald. And you can find all of us together at patreon.com/EDHRetcast.
And I'm Joey Schultz. You can find me online at Joseph M. Schultz. I'm on Instagram now. Check me out there. I'm still figuring out how it works, and I will be for the rest of my adult life. If you've got a question, you can also contact us at edhrecast@gmail.com. And we want to thank, once again, Chase for assisting me with the post-production of the show. You can find Chase online at Mana Curves. Listeners, we'll be back at you next week with more data and insights. But until then, remember, EDH, wreck your deck before you wreck your deck.